Righto, g'day, Money Morning. It's Thursday, 26th of October. Today, we are ripping into the big deal that has been out to the market now for Azure. Me and Trav had a bit of a chat about the offer that we thought was SQM, and it is SQM. And we've got a special guest that is going to take us right into the weeds of this deal. An ex-guest on the potty. I don't think we're giving him away yet.
Nah, we'll build up the suspense, I reckon.
He's on the screen there. He's part of the audience at the moment. But, boys, welcome back, JD. Good to have you back, mate.
Thank you, mate.
Sensational job in Victoria, mate. Excellent interviews. I listened to the Acorn one. I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of them soon, mate. Sensational job flying the flag.
Mate, what have we got today? It's all lithium again.
There's more news out there, but we just don't have time to bloody digest it all because
it's all go at Money
Mine. We get caught up in the lithium news.
Yeah, I know. Buddy, mate, you've got to pretty much go to the level of the Leonora consolidation to take full the top title for the Money in Mind content. So get gold bugs, MDs, get your M&A level up to the level of the Leonora consolidation and you will beat the lithium stories. Right, sponsors for today are great friends at JP Search, Michael and Zav, the financial niche recruitment gurus. Boys, as much as I love them because they took me to golf one day, our relationship goes beyond that because of what they provide to people that are seeking financial employees
in, that's
the,
it,
in the, any M&A, any from all levels of analyst all the way up to CFOs, but their niche, I'll keep saying that.
But it's funny, mate. I was speaking to someone yesterday who works in the executive search industry, and they actually specialize a bit in that CFO level, and they're like, bloody Xavier and Mark and Michael have carved out a monopoly in their niche because other people they go focus on the CFO stuff, but it's competitive there. Bloody mate, Xavier and Michael, the only people you need to speak to if you're looking for a gig in that investment world when you're a young bloke who's got a good chunk of your career ahead of you.
And so they
or gal, by the way.
They help the people find the jobs, but you can help them keep the lights on by looking for a job as well.
That's it. If you are analyst, associate, anything in between and around that, you're working at a Big Four, you're working at a bank,
M&A.
You're working in resources and you want to transition to the finance side of things, get in touch with Sav and Michael at JP Search.
JP Search.
How good's their logo? Good logo, right?
Good logo.
Yeah.
It's a good logo. What else would you do with the words JP?
Yeah. Put them at Gold Square.
Mate, if you need an intro to them, we're happy to set up a WhatsApp conversation because, geez, it looks good when we forward the people on.
The words JP.
Great for the relationship. Righto, boys, let's get into it. Azure, AZS, the hottest lithium stock without a mineral resource, is being bid for their 60% share of the Andover project up in the Pilbara in WA, $1.63 billion.
Matty, what was the price?
$3.52. I feel like I've said that before. $3.52.
Let's just listen to the your prediction, mate, from 2 days ago. Rip it.
Should we take a punt on price, party, and sort of conditionality of the deal?
I'm not betting against you on SQM. I think
SQM,
that's has to be.
My guess on price, so I think it traded as high as 296 in the past, and people always, for whatever reason, get anchored to all-time highs. So my guess is, $3.50.
So if I...
What would you guess on price?
I'll go $3.52.
Wow, mate.
Look.
You can see the future.
We could say it was luck. We could say it was some lithium spiritual guidance that I feel that I felt in that episode. Because once you get that deep in this lithium M&A arena, I feel like the answers are just starting to come to me in the future.
Before you take full credit, Matty, $3.52, well done, kudos. I guessed $3.50 and you guessed
option two.
We're both right. So I received this wicked text from Joel Turco this morning. Shout out, Joel Turco. He said, now we know SQM listens to the show. They managed to bid both $3.50 and $3.52. As you boys guessed, Money of Mine moving the M&A market, mate. I'll take that one.
SQM, happy to help. Fly us over to Chile whenever you want.
Right. All right, guys, that's enough patting on the back, I reckon. You both did a great job. We have a guest on the line here who we alluded to in the preview that we've previously interviewed. We've got Ben Bailey from Harvest Lane on the show. Ben, welcome back to Money of Mine.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Ben. We're very hopeful that you can unpack this deal with us, because it's quite an interesting one, and I'll give a bit of an overview for the money miners. But I think it is important that Azure shareholders, the rest of the market, understand the way that this deal has been designed, because it's been designed intentionally, given the expectation of a disruptive shareholder to enter the arena after watching what happened with Liontown. So,
and they look already smart to have done so, right?
Yeah. I mean, potentially, according to the reporting from the AFR. So you might be scratching your head, wondering how the hell can a company receive a bid at two different prices, $3.50 and $3.52. This deal is structured in a funky way. It's a $3.52 scheme of arrangement. That's the mechanic to execute the deal. But if the scheme fails, it triggers a $3.50 takeover offer, so 2 cents less. It's very funky. And thankfully, we've got Ben Bailey here from Harvest Lane to help us break it down.
So that $3.50 takeover, Trav, that's a cat. That'll be a $3.50 cash.
Both cash.
Offer.
Yeah. Both cash. Just a different mechanism to enact the transaction. And so it's basically this thing called a dual structure deal. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah, it is. You don't often see it, but it has popped up on occasion in the past, and it's essentially a structure that's designed to get around a blocking stake, typically seen by corporate buyers who are happy to just get 50.1% control and not necessarily the full thing.
I'm keen to talk through the mechanics, Ben, noting the parameters that are required to execute a scheme and execute a takeover offer, because that's why it's been structured this way. If you think about a scheme of arrangement, when you want to do a merger via a scheme of arrangement, when you think about the voting thresholds you need, so there's basically two voting thresholds you need for a scheme of arrangement. One is that you need 75% of shareholders by value to vote yes, and greater than 50% of votes by number to vote yes in favour of it. And then on the takeover side, it's a bit of a different threshold. When you think of the Liontown case study that we've just seen, right? Gina bought a 19.9% stake. And what did that give her the ability to do? Well, it basically gave her the ability to block the scheme of arrangement that was proposed to occur, because she now, you're not going to get 100% of people to show up. So even though you need 75% by value to vote, you never get 100% rock up. And that would have been enough to prevent a deal from being executed there.
Yeah, so she actually didn't single-handedly have enough to sort of kill the deal, but effectively 19.9% is enough, given what you just said, that certain people don't vote and all the rest of it.
Because you won't have over 95% of people vote.
Exactly.
Mm. No, and there's probably a good point to clarify there with respect to the differences between the Liontown transaction, you know, the Albemarle was tabling, and also the current SQM one. SQM's an existing 20% shareholder in Azure. They cannot vote their shares as part of the scheme meeting. So the votable base is actually only 80% of the register. So if you take 20% of 80, that's 25%. That in itself would be enough to vote down a scheme of arrangement. Whereas Liontown, based on turnout rates, it was a good indication that Ms. Reinhardt would be able to vote it down. But, you know, if everyone turned out to vote, she wouldn't necessarily have that in her own capacity.
But Tim Goyder wouldn't have been able to vote his shares, would he? He's on the board, isn't he? So
yeah, he's allowed to vote.
Provided there's no collateral benefit. He's an existing shareholder like everyone else. It's the same class of shares. If he was being offered to roll his stake in the unlisted vehicle, he continues on as a shareholder in the private entity, then he would form a different class of shareholders and won't be able to vote alongside the remaining other shareholders. But, you know, given it was entirely cash proposed, he'd be taken out for his shares. So he comes in just like any other shareholder.
Yeah.
So just to confirm, boys, for the non-finance folk, hands up right here. So a scheme of arrangement can be via shares or cash. Is that right? So I was saying the Genesis, St. Barbara, that was a scheme. That was a scheme.
Yeah, it can be both.
Purely shares.
Yeah, both takeovers and schemes can be cash or shares. I think it's more an issue of, or it's more a question of, when you start out looking, you know, to do this change of control transaction, it's a question of how do you structure it. So schemes of arrangement, it goes to shareholders, it goes to a vote, but it's an all or nothing transaction. You either get 100% of the company or you get none of it. Whereas with a takeover offer, it's based on acceptances by shareholders. So you can end up with 20%, 50%, 70%. If you get across that 90%, then you're allowed to compulsorily acquire the remaining 10. But you can end up with a percentage of the company that's not 100.
So an example of that one is what we recently spoke about, Genesis in Dacian being stuck with for a year or so, 80%. Yep. Of the business because those larger shareholders held out.
So a scheme of arrangement is the only way to guarantee if it gets voted yes that you will take 100%.
No, a takeover is the same as long as you get
to the 90%.
Past the 90% and 75% of the ones you don't already own, you reach the compulsory acquisition thresholds.
Yeah.
Let's in this case we've got the two mechanisms kind of tied together, and the way that they're linked is it becomes a takeover offer if the scheme fails, and it's also baked in that the scheme fails if a shareholder other than SQM pops up with greater than 19% shareholding in Azure. In this particular case, you know, I've seen it being dubbed on Twitter as the Gina clause. So there's two ways that the scheme could fail. One is, you know, Gina acquires enough of a stake to actually, you know, the scheme doesn't pass in an actual meeting itself. The other one is she goes above 19%, and that's an explicit condition that the scheme would that is not met by the scheme, and then it kind of kicks in this takeover offer then at $3.50 per share.
Is it greater than 19%, 19.0%?
Just 19, yeah, greater than 19% share.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, Ben, I reckon we should talk through, like, from the perspective of Gina, what her move would be in relation to the deal. Let's talk about the game theory for Gina, because I think that having like been dealt this this deal, like what are her options if she wants to kind of, you know, block a deal similar to the Liontown game plan? I think that can explain why we're seeing it in the structure it is.
So there's no talk of Gina yet. This is pure hypothesizing, preparing, or is there talk that she is interested?
It was AFR, reported in the AFR.
AFR's reporting she's buying with Euroz at the moment. Euroz right. Have traded 15.4% of the stock of Azure today, and speculation that, you know, Gina's been buying.
Sorry, Money Miners, I've been out running errands this morning. Anyway, I'm up to date now. Cheers, boys.
And Euroz were also the broker that did the transactions on the Liontown. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So Ben, bear with me here. If I'm Gina and I see this deal pop up, then I have a decision to make. I either still try and buy shares and disrupt the deal, or in similar to the Liontown version, or I don't. And it appears that it looks like she's trying to disrupt the deal. So she's opted to buy shares. Let's say she reaches a sufficiently large threshold to, you know, cause the scheme not to be effective. Then you're in a situation where the takeover offer kicks in instead. So shareholders of Azure in that instance are going to receive a takeover offer for $3.50 in cash, and Gina is kind of left there in a situation where she can either lobby in a higher bid herself for 100% of Azure, or fold into SQM as well. So, or hold out and SQM, in which case SQM end up with a greater than 50%. Control of Azure, and Gina ends up as a minority shareholder of Azure without board representation, and the board controls Azure, which is controlled by SQM. Is that a fair summary of the options, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, one word to sum that all up: optionality. She's taken a position that, from what I can tell, I don't think she's paid above $3.50. I don't think Euroz were buying higher than that in market today. So, you know, all options are currently available to her, you know, assuming it is her at this stage. You know, when that takeover, you know, she could first and foremost agree to roll into the scheme. If, you know, between now and January, when I think the timetable was set for the scheme meeting to be held, you know, she can opt for that. If not, she can accept into the takeover, or she can just retain an existing stake in Azure, and whether that remains listed or it's delisted by, you know, SQM mopping up everyone else, that's also open to her as well. I think the price that's been paid in market is pretty important to, I guess, the story of what could potentially happen here. To us, it suggests, I guess, optionality. There's no necessarily defining pathway that's opening up in terms of, you know, what we can tell through the purchases. Similar to Liontown, you know, there was, the communication was that she wasn't paying above $3. You know, that would sort of limit her optionality. If you, you know, she might have just thought at the time she could partner with Albemarle, you know, to come in under the bid at $3 and partner with them as a joint bid structure. If she's paid higher than $3 in market, you know, Albemarle would be forced to lift their offer in line with the highest price Gina has paid as well. So that would put pressure on them. So again, essentially what I'm seeing is that she's making a lot of moves that just maximize her optionality. So it's plenty of time to figure out which way she might want to take it.
What does so if option two happens, it's like a Dacian Genesis setup. What's that look like if SQM own 80 and Gina owns 20? Like, would that just be a big ugly weird stalemate?
Well, you got to. I think, you know, we'll go to Ben, but I think you got to think of what Gina's intentions are as well. Would she be satisfied doing that? Because that sort of vehicle, you know, she's a minority shareholder. She doesn't have control, and the entity's controlled by the board, not her. And if that's an unpalatable outcome for her, then she's kind of got to make a decision whether or not she lobs a bid at a higher price herself, if that's an unpalatable outcome, at a price at which SQM kind of, you know, folds into, which would be a pretty interesting thing to see, I think.
Yeah. So I think, it comes back to the structuring and, you know, the deliberate decision to structure it as a dual structure transaction. So first and foremost, you go for a scheme of arrangement, which is an all or nothing outcome. SQM ideally would like 100% of Azure, but by offering this off-market takeover, in the event that the scheme fails, they're signaling to market that they're not necessarily about control add to their position. They're happy to take the whole thing, and they're reserving their rights, I guess, with respect to, you know, where they go between 20% and 100% of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, Gina's also got the capability to come over the top as well. You know, whether she'd be happy to stay at a 20% interest where you've got a minority stake, whether it's listed or unlisted, you know, I can't speak to what her thoughts are. You know, I'd love to have the inside line to just pick up the phone and have a yarn, but don't have that luxury.
But that point of it being unlisted, right, is something to tease out, because quite often in these situations you see the threat is to delist it if shareholders don't fold into a takeover offer. So I think, you know, we saw that with Wyloo
Mincor.
That would be what SQM would have up their sleeve as a possibility. They would threaten to kind of delist the entity, at which point Gina loses some of the protections that come with being a listed company per ASX listing rules. And it's just a lot harder to kind of, you know, advocate for your own agenda under those circumstances as a shareholder.
Yeah. I mean, to delist under a takeover transaction, you need 75% acceptances. And I think there's the number of remaining shareholders has to be under a certain amount. I think it's 100, it could be 50, but one of the two seems roughly right. So, you know, that was the case in the Genesis Dacian deal. They got past 75, but there was enough of an existing shareholder base that they couldn't delist the thing there. So with respect to Azure, there's nothing, you know, even if Gina would like to retain a 19.9% stake, the maximum SQM can get to is 80.1, or, you know, 80%, we'll call it roughly. If they get to 75 and there's fewer than, call it 100 shareholders, they can, you know, delist it from there, and then it just rolls into an unlisted vehicle and Gina would retain her stake. SQM have taken out most of the remaining shareholders, so it just becomes, I guess, Gina, Creasy and SQM.
Ben, can you sort of just tease out why the risk profile for an Azure shareholder right now is completely different to the risk profile that Liontown shareholders had a few weeks ago?
It's mainly to do, well, you've got this dual structure. So you've got the takeover that comes in the event the scheme fails. The conditionality of that is really not all that onerous. So it'll be at a point where there's a very, very high confidence that at the end of all this, you'll be able to cash out at $3.50. I don't think, you know, the takeover is still conditional, but, you've got things like FIRB approval is required. I don't think that'll be an issue given that they currently have a partnership with Wes Farmers for Mount Holland. Existing operations in Australia, it's not going to throw up too many issues from a national interest perspective, I would think. But there's no minimum acceptance they have to get to. Basically, SQM is just flagging that they're happy to buy as many shares as they can at the offer price. And if it's only 5% of the register, they'll take it. If it's, the whole thing, they'll take that as well.
Yeah. And of course, for that takeover to then become, compulsory, you need the 90% threshold, which you can't get unless Gina sort of comes to party, but that's where you kind of get a potential
situation. Yeah, unless she plays ball.
Yeah.
Yeah, unless she plays ball, there's no pathway to compulsory.
Yeah. Ben, I'm keen to kind of talk about the strategy on announcement here. So I couldn't help but have the reflection. I always look who's advising on the deal, and I see advising Azure in defence is Baron Joey, and Baron Joey, of course, were advising Albemarle. when it looks like they might not be getting paid on that deal, but they've learned their lesson and they've advised a deal structure that might get an outcome in the case of Azure. So let's talk.
But they might get paid for.
Yeah,
yeah.
Let's talk about the strategy here, right? So. They don't announce anything until like a scheme implementation deed or transaction implementation deed, what they term it, is actually signed, as opposed to in Liontown's case, they announce that there's an intention to merge that's subject to 4 weeks of DD. They didn't do that, didn't announce that. DD might have already happened, but they announce it after the binding docs have been signed and there's this structure as a protective mechanism. It's clearly designed to mitigate the potential influence of Gina to disrupt a deal because of what they've seen in Liontown, I think.
And I think we said the other day they haven't got much to do DD on. Yeah.
Like, what is it? A bit different.
You just got drill call.
But
I mean, this is binding from the outset. So, there's a legal document that binds SQM to certain obligations under the transaction, whereas the Albemarle one was indicative non-binding subject to XYZ. So again, that speaks to the higher confidence that you'll get a decent outcome here. And it's just a case of, I guess, seeing what transpires over the next few months.
Ben, what's your thoughts on timing and coincidence or not? Do you think it's coincidence that you've got Gina buying all the Liontown shares, Albemarle's bid being taken back, you've got SQM putting the offer in right now. Is this just a big race to the top that's happening now or pure coincidence?
I think it's pretty interesting because it's all coming at the time where, we're hearing about price weakness in lithium markets and, there's going to be massive or not massive, but, there's threats of oversupply and the price is just going to keep falling and all that sort of stuff. And, you look at these transactions and everyone's racing for it. It's things like MinRes picking up 20% of Delta as well. They're in global lithium. It just sort of seems that the ones with the cash to throw around building these things out aren't necessarily worried about what the current picture is. They're looking forward to the future and willing to kind of put their money where their mouth is, backing what the outlook is. It's a pretty interesting one to follow. I mean, we're not necessarily in the game of predicting what's going to be the next one. It's more a reactionary to what's in front of us, but what's happening now can certainly sort of help give us context for what is to come.
And in just in this 2 week period, do you think the reason SQM has put this bid out now is to get on the front foot against Gina Rinehart, looking at her activity?
You go back to my little tip for you, Trav, in the podcast we did, you look at the date the confidentiality agreement was signed, 13th of October. So
oh, I didn't
it's less than 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, 13 days ago.
So,
but SQM did bid 3 months ago. So,
yeah.
It's interesting what you say about the sort of disparity between how the market is viewing lithium prices, you know, medium term, to how the corporates are. There seems to be a real disparity. You're seeing the corporates really getting on the front foot, going after these acquisitions, but the market, in, you know, it's reflected in the prices of Pilbara and the like, has been coming off quite a bit. Obviously, we've heard the same reports that lithium prices are off. I think the latest was I read that 37% over the past, you know, month or so. So spodumene price is sitting a bit over $2,000, but the corporates are clearly taking a view that that is, like you say, short-term, you know, inventory challenges, macro challenges, all those sorts of things, as opposed to a more medium to long-term view.
Ben?
Yeah, I mean, you just look at the Pilbara Minerals quarterly today and their realised price on the spodumene. You had Chris Ellison from MinRes on his quarterly conference call, you know, sort of bemoaning about price manipulation for the markets as well. So, you know, the ones that are actually there doing the work, they seem to, you know, indicate at least with their actions that, you know, the current market isn't necessarily where the expectation is it'll all head.
Hmm. Ben, the speaking of like the things to pick up on in the transaction docs on market, I noticed a matching right in there to SQM. So in the situation that Gina decides to lob a bid at a higher price when it gets to a takeover, if it gets to a takeover, then SQM have a right to match it as well, which is also interesting. The other point I wanted to talk about is Mark Creasy and how he fits into all of this. Of course, he's got the other 40%. He's also a...
We're only talking about 60% here, are we?
Yeah.
Wonder what's going to happen with that 40%
as well as the project.
I'm sure he's had plenty of approaches for his 40%.
His phone would be going off his tits, I reckon.
Playing the long game, seemingly. Now, the AFR, of course, reporting that looks like Gina's been buying the shares. Ben, I'm keen to get your view on what you make of the fact that Delphi, who owned less than Creasy, basically supplied an indication to support the transaction, but we didn't see the same vote of support from Creasy Group and their holding. And then could it be Creasy actually selling his shares to Gina right now? Like, what could be any motivation around that? I mean, what are your thoughts on Creasy's stake and why we saw Delphi provide an intention but not Creasy?
Because he's got, what, 13% of Azure he can sell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they approached Creasy about whether he'd be, you know, willing to publicly commit his stake to the current transaction. You know, they've got Delphi on board as the next largest shareholder. So, you know, you don't start with the number two shareholder, you go to the number one. So it is pretty interesting. Again, I think it just comes back to this optionality. We've still got several months for this transaction to play out. By at the outset committing your stake in favor, you know, or, you know, that you will commit a certain action, you're held by takeover law that says, you know, once you make a public statement, you therefore have to act in accordance with that. Otherwise, you could be deemed to be misleading the market, you know, by, I guess, bluffing and trying to get a different outcome to what you're publicly on record stating. So I don't necessarily know if he's selling on market at the moment. We don't know if he's in favour. But I think, you know, the fact that he hasn't decided to publicly support it from the outset, I think it's just a case of optionality. There's no need to at the moment. SQM are pretty aggressive. You know, they're happy with none or, you know, not happy with none, but they're happy to get as little or as many as they can. There's no need to throw support behind it to encourage other shareholders as well.
What scenarios and the likelihood of each do you think is going to happen with Mark Creasy's 40% stake in the project?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, it's free carried through to FID, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd imagine he'd make the decision around that time and not sooner unless someone makes him an offer that's way too good to refuse.
Yeah, so he's setting himself up for glory.
Yeah, it's as well because that 40% stake is held separately to Azure. You can have different prices paid for it. You know, if you offer a cash sum to one shareholder, it has to be the same for everyone. Everyone has to have the right to participate on the same terms. But because that 40% is just held by Creasy is, you know, at the joint venture level and not necessarily via a 40% stake in Azure who owns 100% of the project, you know, he can tease out a different offer to what is being offered to Azure shareholders today.
But Woody is in a position to get like a massive, massive premium in terms of if they get to the stage of FID, it's like, well, we can either buy you out now or you have to chip in 40% of the CapEx. So isn't that – that's the downside for him is that he would have to
– You can probably find a way to fund that.
But like is that – that would be a potential out is like – so he hasn't got him completely by the balls because his best bet would be to get paid out so he doesn't have to chip in for the CapEx, wouldn't he?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, look at what he did when he had the Nova deposit with Sirius, right? It's not like he just took an offer from IGO and took cash and left. He actually rolled his position into IGO shares. So he obviously had a view that I want the economic upside that this deposit gets me. And maybe he takes a similar view on this deposit and wants in some way, shape or form to have some long-term exposure to its prosperity.
Without the exposure to paying the bill.
Yeah. I got another one for you. Oh, sorry, you go, Ben.
Rip it, Ben.
While we've got you, mate,
we're getting everything out of you we can.
I was just going to say, I mean, he can cede a bit of equity interest in his 40% stake in exchange for what the capital commitment is at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't necessarily take shares in the bidder. He can just cede equity interest, you know, move down from a 40 to a 20% in exchange for, you know, whoever takes out that position fronts up the equivalent amount of CapEx that, you know, the implied value is.
Ben, I had another thought reflecting on this deal structure, and one is that if this deal results in it going to the takeover thing and then instead of the scheme, and then Gina chucks in a higher bid and then you get that bid matched by SQM, then all of a sudden there's a pathway to 100%. Does Albemarle reappear at Liontown now knowing the playbook to get a deal done with Gina? Is this kind of a potential path forward for Liontown now?
It could be. It just depends on where Gina is prepared to be a seller and if that's a price that Albemarle can afford. I think SQM, they're on the front foot now. They've already got an existing 20% stake. So they're sort of pot committed with seeing something get over the line here, whereas I think Albemarle, they weren't even substantial at the time they made the offer. You know, it could all just get a little bit difficult. Maybe they're wishing they went harder earlier on to pick up a pre-bid stake. It's just about finding a clearing price. Everyone's got a price for something to be done. So it's just a case of whether Albemarle will be able to afford it.
Mm. I suppose you look at what's happened to Albemarle. They've put all the offers in, but they haven't had to cough up any money at $2.50 to $3 for Liontown. But now they do have the opportunity to start picking them up cheaper. And if they do, as you said, does it still open the door for them to do a JV deal with Gina, but they don't have to pay $3 anymore?
Mm, yeah, potentially. There's one more for the deal junkies out there, Ben. Like, when have you seen this transaction done in the past? I was in a conversation with Mr. Spector, our go-to corporate lawyer who remains anonymous, and he told me it's the first time in WA that this dual structure's been part of an M&A transaction.
It's not. I mean, it might be in WA. It's not the first time I've seen these deal structures. We've typically seen it. I think Healthscope was the first one in 2019 where Brookfield came over the top of BGH, had an existing 20% stake, and they offered this dual transaction structure to kind of get around that. The carrot on the stick for shareholders and for BGH as well was that if they folded and rolled into the scheme, they were given a higher price, and if they stayed firm and, you know, Brookfield didn't get 100%, then the price would be lower to reflect the fact that, you know, there's a certain premium in, I guess, taking 100% ownership as opposed to just having a controlling stake. So I think, you know, the scheme offered by Brookfield there was 250 and the takeover was 240. So there's, you know, there's a bit of a price step there in terms of consideration received. I was a bit surprised with the Azure one because it's only 2 cent difference. You know, it's less than 1%. So, I'm convinced they just listened to the pod.
I was just about to say, I think it was just purely us. Yeah.
Just for shits and giggles, throw 2 cents on, give it up for Maddie. But, perhaps they took the view that they weren't going to get the scheme up anyway, and this is just an exercise in trying to pick up as many shares as they can at that $3.50 price.
Well, mate, we're all the wiser, and thank you for sharing your expertise. And for those that don't know, Ben spends all day diving into the docs that go up on the ASX when it comes to an M&A transaction, because that's how they make money at Harvest Lane.
Right, this is a yes or no question to finish it, Ben. Is Azure an arbitrage play right now?
In a pure sense, it closed $3.49, and you're looking at $3.50 in a few months, so you can make 1 cent arbitrage. Technically, it is.
Technically,
for the money miners, that
with a holding period and cost of borrow on top of that, and actually no borrow because it's just a cash offer. Yeah,
but does an arbitrage play include potential outcomes like Gina things, or is arbitrage purely just on the numbers?
Arbitrage is purely how can you get a return without any risk taken. But the way that the corporate action kind of strategy of Harvest Lane, correct if I'm wrong here, Ben, is you look at an opportunity to make a return, but you're exposed to the upside that comes from a counter offer, and that's where you kind of you lock in a minimum return, but you get the kicker if there's a bit of a bidding war.
Yeah. So by the letter of the law, I guess this is technically an arbitrage opportunity, but, being so close to that takeover price, time value of money, what you're paying for here is the expectation that there's a little bit more to come, is how I'll reference that. So whether you think that's a strong possibility or not, I'll leave it over to the viewers to kind of have their own opinions on that. But you're paying for potential here, a pure arbitrage.
In repayment for this interview, Ben, once this deal goes through, we just want you to come back on and say what your play was here on a trading sense. Once it's done you won't get in trouble. So money miners, stay tuned for 6 months' time.
If Ben's not talking, it means he's buying shares and he's trying to bloody get a higher price.
Leave that up to the money miners. Right, man. Thanks for coming on, Cobber. Nothing like anything out of market hours. We usually get better attendees. So
yeah, that was wicked, mate.
Cheers, boys. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you, mate. See Cheers. Ya. We will should be up soon.
Look forward to hearing it.
Thanks, Ben.
The episode and the Azure share price. Righto, good on you, Benny Bailey. What an absolute GC. Loves it. Good for an aftermarket call, that fella. And always gets a bit of real good insight.
Yeah, wicked. I mean, that's serious insight that you just don't get. Even as an investment banker, you never really talk deal structuring in this sort of way. This is really rare to see. You don't see it in mining deals. It might be the first one in WA we've seen, but it's really cool to have someone who's at the coalface of deal structuring, explain it, pull it apart for the layman.
Unless you got these bloody blokes or ladies' numbers, personal friends, there's no other way to get this insight other than listening to Money of Mine, boys.
It's true, mate.
This is what we are providing to the industry.
Yep.
So, no worries. Thanks for all the bloody pats on the back.
You cracked me up, mate.
We will take credit for Ben's insight.
Yes. We'll take credit for getting Ben to you, the money miner.
Let's talk about Pilbara Minerals.
Pilbara, PLS. Jesus, talk about bloody having half of its body shorted. What was it leading about 15% shorted?
Most shorted stock on the ASX, I think 15.5%.
And 15.5% is a very, very high amount of shorting. You look at that shortman.com, usually the top shorted stock's around 9 or 10% shorted.
Yeah, on the ASX, yep.
15's high and it's not.
15's very high.
And it's not even a stock with balance, balance sheet stress. It's kind of net cash. There's no debt.
I think Liontown was shorted 9.8% leading into the Albemarle bill being pulled, bid being pulled. So 15% for this stock.
Yeah, and we'll
got three fucking bills in.
Yeah, we'll get into more. That was one of the key talking points, the interest around there, because I'm not sure if you guys picked up on the same sort of rhetoric, but this, I haven't felt the market and people so interested in what a quarterly is going to say as the Pilbara one. They feel like a lot of excitement about, you know, a number of different questions. And the main one is around pricing and then sort of how that flows into why it is one of the most, or in the case of the last couple of months, the most shorted stock on the ASX. So, you know, all up at the end of the day, Maddie, we just looked before, the stock was flat. So, you know, people were thinking, oh, pricing's going to be a massive disappointment. They, you know, in a sense, they were vindicated, like pricing was down massively quarter on quarter, but they weren't rewarded for it if they were short the stock. So getting into the details on pricing, they realized US$2,550 per dry metric ton. That was a 31% drop quarter on quarter. And obviously it's coming from pretty high highs.
That's on an SC6 basis, is it, Jay?
That's right.
And they sold 5.3%.
Yeah, so on 5.3%, you're talking about 2,240.
SC6, Joe Lowry, if you're listening, mate, we know you love it.
So there was an interesting sort of quirk as to why the pricing, you know, came off so much. They had maintenance at the berth at Port Hedland. And that meant sales were weighted toward the September month as opposed to the two earlier months in the quarter. And as prices were on the slide throughout the quarter, it meant they received pretty weak pricing. But, I mean, the theme has sort of been reflected in the likes of MinnS and all the other lithium producers in the quarterlies that we've seen over the past week or so, that lithium prices are on the slide. The latest number that I picked up upon, I'm not sure if you guys had seen this, was that SC6 spod FOB Australia was being priced at $2,050 a ton, or if you're looking on a CIF China basis, just add $100. So that's a bit of a far cry from where we were about a year ago.
Yeah.
But you know, at the sort of margins, you know, we're talking operating costs on a unit basis for Pilbara around 1,000 Aussie.
Yeah. So that's CIF. That's cost, insurance, and freight to get it to China, and that adds $100 to the $100 to the price because you got to pay the
freight and the insurance and so on. Yeah, exactly. So in terms of revenue came off 42% for Pilbara. So like I said, you've seen prices come off over 30%. You also saw lower production. So 144,000 tons of spodumene was produced, which is, you know, a bit lower than consensus was sort of anticipating.
Did they, in their previous quarterly, did they guide that they were going to be second half weighted during the P680 ramp up?
They did. So
for the financial year,
they got a few, you know, bits and pieces of machinery, equipment, the plant that they're fine tuning, they're getting going, they're commissioning, all those sorts of things. Yeah. So there were some maintenance shutdowns and the like throughout the last quarter. So one of the big sort of pieces that they refer to is the P680 primary rejection facility. So a nice big picture of it for Trav in the quarterly, and that's going to be commissioned, you know, throughout the next quarter. In terms of recovery, 67%. That's, you know, perhaps slightly softer, more or less flattened, like in line with what they had guided to.
I think it was at like last quarter was what, 72? I think they were sitting at low 70s prior to that.
Yeah. And they had sort of flagged a bit of a weakness in that upcoming. Operationally across the board, you've got the P1000, which essentially gets them to 1 million tonnes per annum production on track. They've got the JV with POSCO in South Korea. So things are moving ahead. Train one is 77% complete. Train two, 44% complete. Now, Maddie, we're going to get into the real stuff, the cash.
Cash.
So $3.3 billion was the figure they had at the end of the last quarterly. And since then, they've obviously paid a dividend. So they've, you know, various capex and other expenses has seen them finish this quarter at $3 billion Aussie in cash. And now they do have a chunky tax bill coming up, over $770 million. So you'd expect them to finish the year in the sort of region of $2.2 billion in cash.
Is that the same tax bill that was flagged last quarter, or is that this a new one?
Yeah, so that's the tax bill for FY23, and it's going to be paid in the December quarter.
Yeah.
So, you know, $2.2 billion in cash, you think, oh, maybe they're a contender. All this M&A is going on, but you know, I don't really think so. They've got to get to P1000, which we just touched upon. That's going to see over, you know, around about $1 billion in capex over FY24. And then, you know, that's not all of it. There's going to be some capex that needs to be spent afterwards. Obviously, they're going to be growing the cash pile throughout as well. But, I mean, the dollar figures we're talking about, you know, with the likes of Azure and even, you know, Wildcat, for example, the market caps.
Wildcat.
The market caps on these things are chunky now. So,
and PLS hasn't bought minority stakes, right? Like everyone else has, but they haven't. So it would just be.
Yeah, Wildcat was a small cap. Now Wildcat's a big cap. So, and like, but you think of like, say they got $2 billion and they want to go and take someone over. Like, say they wanted to bid for Azure. Think of the time it would take to get a return on that money, the balance sheet pressure, and like, you wouldn't think it's a play in the wheelhouse of Pilbara with a one asset project, do you think? The way with their organic expansion and growth that they've got going on at the moment, would you see it as a.
Remember, inorganic growth is one of their four pillars, the fourth one. And, you know, I imagine in due course they'll look to be opportunistic. When we spoke with Dale, he spoke, you know, about the desire to deploy that capital for inorganic opportunities at a time when you have depressed lithium prices and the opportunities out there at more attractive valuations. I imagine they've just got a different, you know, long-term lithium price in their models than all the other players, and they can't sort of compete on value when they put it through their own requirements. So
yeah,
and I think the sort of way they've gone about it has served them quite well. They had a comment on pricing and how that's going to look over the short term, and what they said was that it's going to continue to remain volatile. You know, on the basis of all the macro trends, we'd seen reports of slower EV sales and, you know, tightly held inventories across, you know, across Asia and across the world, really.
And I think lithium prices is one thing, but it's the competitive landscape for people to acquire all these lithium projects at the moment. That's the thing that's heated up. So it's irrelevant what the stocks are getting valued at. It's what people are bidding for them at the moment to take them over.
Yeah. And you can see, you know, their focus right now is just getting the operations going. They've got a lot going on. As we saw when we went up there to get P680 humming, to get up to P1000, they'll be looking to fine-tune the operations. As the production increases, you'd expect the unit costs that I quoted earlier to come down as well. So they're very much focused on that at the minute, and it's sort of served them well. On the short interest that we spoke about, price, so 15.5.
Give us the long and the short of it, JD.
How long do you have that one loaded up for, mate?
Mate, I'm just there flowing today.
So there's a few different reasons why you think that Pilbara is the most shorted stock on the ASX. So firstly, if you're short lithium equities, Pilbara is, you know, without doubt the easiest way to get that sort of exposure. It's the biggest, most liquid name. It doesn't have the same sort of huge major shareholders like we see in a lot of the other stocks. i.e. it's probably easier to get borrow. That's an assumption I'm making. I don't know that one for a fact. On a sort of more fundamental basis, you might be anticipating there's some ramp-up risk at P680 and P1000 or perhaps other operational issues that they're going to have, recoveries, the plant, all those sorts of things. And then there's one other sort of layer which, you know, we've kind of beaten around the bush of just now, is that they might go and do some poor M&A and destruct value. I don't think they will, but that could be another lens that a short seller might take to as a reason for shorting Pilbara. But I think it really hinges around the first thing I said there, that it's the most liquid name. And if you're bearish on lithium, that's probably one of the easiest ways to sort of express that sentiment.
I think that's an interesting one to go into, right? Because go back last year, if you wanted to be short lithium, you wouldn't have expressed your short lithium view via Pilbara, because you would express it via, you know, the assets that were further out on the risk curve that had dubious development plans, and that was the way to be short. But now those have all like come way off. They've all fallen off a cliff. They've actually, a lot of them have dropped out of the indexes. So getting borrowers a lot more costly.
For the big funds, I'd say impossible. They're too small. The position sizes aren't meaningful enough for those names we're thinking of that have just fallen so far.
Liontown, it wasn't the one to short because it was, you know, subject to a bid at $3 forever. And of course, then the short's built up with the junior anticipation. But just from a lithium short, you kind of go through the list and a lot of it probably does relate to that fact. Even though, you know, historically you would have thought, if I want to be short lithium, I'm going to short the worst companies as opposed to ones that have a durable balance sheet in a project. But there was another one I've been asking around about this question too, JD, and like why, you know, what are people pitching in order to try and encourage others to be short Pilbara? A few things I heard. One was that because the pricing was expected to be lower, all of the brokers were using the wrong price, and then you'd see downgrades as a result of that. So then you just see sort of price targets kind of readjust, and there was an expectation that that would happen after the broker downgrades. Another thing that I'd heard was people weren't properly factoring in their cash position with the tax liability, and that would kind of flow through the markets. And then other people were expecting some seasonal weakness. Fascinating to see kind of just it's traded flat. So we'll see what happens next.
Yeah, I mean, for all the excitement and all the buzz coming into how this one was going to do, you thought it was going to move one way or the other, but at the end of the day, it's just finished flat. So there you go.
Do you think it should be traded a bit differently to something like this ramp up to P1000 eventually in comparison to, say, a Liontown? Liontown are going zero to, 700,000-odd tonnes a spot. So yeah. Pilbara, they've essentially got locked in 500,000 tonne already of spot in the plant that has already been commissioned and already flowing, and everything's just a separate bolt onto all that. Like, it's essentially that additional capacity is decoupled from what they've successfully got already. Where it's, as much of a risk compared to someone that's ramping up a full plant from zero to.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I do think the more switched on investors would view it in that lens. You know, if they're sort of modelling.
Switched on investor right here, right?
if they're modelling, 1 million tonnes per annum of production, it's not binary. You know, they're already at almost 600,000 and stuff. So it's how close do they get to that? Do they get it? Do they fall 20% short or whatever in the in the coming couple financial, years? That's how they sort of view it.
Yeah. Beauty, boys. We're going to do, because pretty much every other commodity MD is going to be sooking today because of lithium again, and we're going to deliver the other quarterlies tomorrow because obviously, as I said, get your M&A standards up to the appropriate level that will guarantee you a spot on Money of Mine.
Mate, $1.6 billion
deal. I don't think we are because we've got an interview tomorrow, mate.
Oh, do we? No, that one's, we'll do a show before that.
Roger.
Piece of piss, mate. Don't worry. Don't worry, Money Mourners. We won't let you down. We've got the Sand Fire De Grey Orchem quarterlies coming out today. Plenty of others. We'll do a bloody quick rip through and I'll attempt to summarise it a bit better than I did the other day.
Yep, and we've said it earlier, but we are going to be in Sydney next week.
Yes, IMARC.
So if you're around, come say g'day, and we might be going to
Tuesday night.
Yeah, going to a pub on Tuesday night, so... TBA.
Don't come to the pub and pitch me your bloody big small cap opportunity and like what happened to Diggers on the Street all the time. God, one guy's like bloody giving me a dart and saying, mate, I'll just get it, mate, tell him your story. Tell us what your company's about. I couldn't even have a dart.
I just want the dart.
Can I have the cigarette?
I'm glad they came for you and not me, Matty. I got none of that.
All right, lads.
Yeah, so, no, and we're not just going to be at IMARC, JD. Money of Mine is the official podcast partner for the IMARC conference. So we're going to be set up in the flesh, in the conference, interviewing all the who's who around IMARC, just picking five people out of 8,500. So it's going to be brilliant. So look forward to, I wish I could have a beer with every one of you, but I'd get way too messed up. And beauty. Right,
on that note, thanks, Smek.
On that note is a translation for hurry up, Matthew.
No, I thought you were going to round out the show, mate. So
yeah, great partners, JP Search, the financial recruitment gurus at the top of the show, along with all our other great partners, Smek Power and Technology, the electrical gurus.
K-Drill,
RC Drilling and Man Rock Excavation gurus.
Anytime.
Anytime exploration, just overall exploration, recruitment, vehicle hire, and everything exploration gurus.
Terra Capital,
just gurus of people, but also natural resource investing gurus.
That's it. Hoodaroo, lads.
If you'd like to be a guru, you let us know. We can get you on the guru list. Cheers, Money Miners.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.